Hello and welcome to another episode of Transformational Blueprints, where we try to put a dent in the large number of transformation programs that fail. Hosted by me, Mario Michaels, founder and director of Synaxia Group. On this series, we will bring you unique insights drawn from first-hand experience from some of the most high-profile architecture and transformation leaders across the globe. Topics told in order to share knowledge, experiences, and ideas to inspire, innovate, and give back to the architecture community. So grab a coffee, sit back, and relax. Welcome, everybody. Today, we'll be talking to Mike Chapman about the role of enterprise architecture in an agile environment. Mike started working for an EPOS supplier as a level one support desk analyst. Then he rose through the ranks there. He then joined EDS as a contractor. So he left a permanent job, took a leap of faith, went into contracting. And that was where he started transitioning from an engineer into an architect. Mike then went into consultancy and spent several years in a technical architect, then solution architect, and even a pre-sales role. More recently, Mike has been the head of architecture for Together Money, leading projects around the AML space, core finance, and HR transformation. Now, while working full-time and raising two kids, being happily married, Mike has also just recently completed a master's degree in digital technology and solutions specialist. Mike, welcome to the pod.
Hi, Mario. Thank you for having me.
No problem at all. Well, we always start off with a bit of a background, and I'll give a brief synopsis, but tell us how you got to where you are now, Mike.
Yeah, like you said, so I started, first of all, left school with just GCSEs and kicked around hospitality industry for a while. Mum and dad telling me to go and get a proper job, like they do, trying to look out for you. And then I got a role in an EPOS supplier that no longer exists, unfortunately. Spent a number of years there working through various roles and then left there and moved to another, be director business organization, did a short stint there. And then, as you said, took a leap of faith into working for EDS. Mm-hmm. Now, that was an interesting one. Basically, I was going through the process of selling my house.
Yep.
And the team lead for my future team was there. I had a rig set up at home like most engineers did back then, playing with VMware, Enterprise Server, Exchange, SQL,
yep,
et cetera, et cetera. And he's like chatting with tech and he said, oh, I've got some roles coming up. Do you fancy going for one of them? And I went, okay.
The person that was buying your house or selling his house to you?
No, the person that was buying my house. So I went from a permanent role to a contract gig on a 3-month rolling contract. It was very much a leap of faith. Spent quite a bit of time there as a contractor, and then EDS were going through a session of shifting from contractors to permits. So I did the move, gave them a number, also said that I want to go to uni.
Mm-hmm.
So that's when I did my first degree.
Yep.
And I went permanent, and I moved from being a level 3 support engineer to my first stint in architecture.
Yep.
Stayed there for a period of time, and then I moved to CSC, where I spent 10 years of my career. I moved there, started another degree, because you can't have too many.
Too many degrees.
All of my degrees are around technology and related field or one or the other.
Okay.
Did five years there as a TA and an SA, working on various large programs across multiple industry verticals.
Yep.
And then moved into pre-sales solution lead. I did that for, I think, about 6 years, five or 6 years, working on some big IT outsourcing programs of work, which took me into Europe as well as UK and I.
Yep.
That was a very interesting time. And every single one of those contracts or IT outsourcing deals had transformation in them.
Yep.
Without fail. And then second child came along, various other things happened. I mean, from there to Accenture, second child came along, and then it was like consulting back then. It was 5 days a week.
Yep.
On the road, long shift, long hours, didn't quite work for having a family. So I moved into pensions and life, spent a number of years in pensions and life as a lead SA. and then moved into head of architecture at Together Money, which is a specialist finance lending organization.
Quite the career. So what do you think makes a great architect then in today's world? Because you would have come across, you probably then will go on to your leadership career in a moment, but you would have come across many, many architects. And which were the ones that really stood out, and why do they stand out?
There's quite a few that have really stood out, and the ones that stood out are the ones that could decipher a business problem.
Okay.
The ones that struggled were very technically capable,
yep.
Very, very technically capable, but didn't have that business brain,
didn't
understand the what they were enabling, what they were unlocking, and they would stay very focused on the technical solution. The ones that really excelled understood the why, and also understood that actually, as a solution architect, and also moving onwards into an EA role, you're not just looking at technology, you're looking at the wider business. Sometimes the right answer is, you don't touch the tech, then you fix business process, and you go, actually, this is a business process. If you rework those processes, you will get the desired outcome, and the best architects understand that.
Okay. Would you say your role in pre-sales helped you develop that skill?
Yes. Role in pre-sales was interesting. You've got a number of things that you need to take into account. Price is always important, but getting it right is probably more important. So if you're the most expensive player on the pitch, which we had been in some cases, you got to understand and sell why you're the most expensive player on the pitch. I know that some of my colleagues pitched for some various bits of business and they didn't get it, but they were the best overall bid. And those organizations actually ran into some trouble later on because we would say, this is going to cost you £15 million to do your transformation.
Yeah.
$50 million, for example. And somebody else would come in and say, it's going to cost you five.
Yeah.
They'd look at our stack and go, yeah, you properly covered everything, but they say they can do it for less.
Yeah.
In the end, it costs them 20 million.
And buy cheap, buy twice.
Yeah, exactly. And that is the bit. The bit is trying to articulate why you are the best value proposition, why it ticks the boxes, why the business side is so important.
Yeah.
And that your answers are not all just laying technical architecture, technical solutions are not the silver bullet.
Yeah. Okay. Fair enough. So tell us a little bit about your leadership career then. Tell us about the size of the team, what the makeup of those teams have been, just to give us some context into that side of things.
People don't see necessarily solution architecture where I started and technical architecture necessarily as a leadership role, because you don't have line management, but you are leading teams. So back then I'd have a team of a couple, maybe a couple of engineers that I'd be leading in a matrix just for the delivery of the program. Mm-hmm. And then as I moved into bid work, I could have a team of 30 or 40 people sat behind me.
Yep.
They would be specialists in workplace, infrastructure services, networking, service management, applications, the list goes on.
Mm-hmm.
And you would be funneling all of their inputs into your proposal.
Yep.
Be working directly with a salesperson on that. So you're leading them in a direction. And there's two ways you could do that. You can either ask for everybody's opinion on what we should do, which doesn't always get you the right outcomes. And also a lot of people find that really difficult.
Yep.
So the way I prefer to lead is I take what we were trying to achieve for the organization and put together a framework, a straw man.
Yep.
And then I'd run a number of workshops or sessions about how we develop that quite happily. There's shoot holes in it all over the place.
Yeah.
Well, that's why, because you've given them a starter for 10 to shoot.
Yep.
So I'd lead them in that way. And then under the principle that no answer is the wrong answer, just speak up. And then now in my current role, I've got line management responsibility as well, which is something that I've not had previously. And it's trying to balance that line management piece with also personnel development and the other bits that I did previously as matrix management.
Yeah, exactly. And what with that, you want to be building a high performance team, and everybody always talks about high performance and whatnot. How do you go about building a high performance team?
To build a high performance team, you have to understand what your strengths and weaknesses are across the team. So if you have everybody that's a go-getter, for want of a better word, or a high-performing individual, and you have an entire team of those, actually your team's probably going to fail, because you need people that also just want to come in and do the job.
Yep.
They're quite happy with the job that they do. They will excel at the job that they do, but they're not trying to push beyond that.
Yep.
So it's about understanding the roles of the individuals, where they're comfortable, and then building the team around those pieces and putting those pieces of the puzzle in the right place.
Yeah. Okay. You mentioned earlier that technology sometimes might not be the answer, but where it is the answer, how can technology teams demonstrate they're an enabler rather than a blocker? And the reason I ask that is because historically technology teams or IT teams have always been a cost center. And because they're a cost center, they need to demonstrate their value. And the way they often demonstrated their value was through sort of control, no shadow IT, no whatever it may be, just everything so we control it. Whereas now technology should be used as an enabler. So this is the business problem we've got. We believe this piece of technology can help it or solve that problem, pardon me. So how can technology teams demonstrate that that's the message to the rest of the business or to the customer depending on what the context is?
So one of the things that I'm trying to get my technology teams to do and always have done is also look beyond the scope. And this is where I think the value proposition comes in a bit. You've been asked to solve problem Y, and to solve problem Y, you're bringing in technology X. Okay.
Yep.
But then if you have a good enough understanding of the ecosystem within the organization, X may actually also be able to fix a number of other problems or add value in a number of other places across the business. And one of the things that I ask my architects to do is to call that out and go, this technology stack, it's really powerful. We've got, it's going to overlap its capability in these areas.
Mm.
Therefore, should we now investigate how we can expand out the use of this technology into those areas and decommission other capabilities from a technical perspective, which then reduce the overall spend that we've got? Or the spend may seem neutral, but the output and the quality and the value that we're delivering is increased, and therefore you get a better set of outcomes. And it's always looking for the additional ways you can service the estate that you operate within.
Yep.
With the tools that you've got. One of the things that technologists historically have been really good at, to the detriment, I think, of organizations, is looking at the next greatest thing and just pushing or advocating for that without necessarily understanding the BAU impact that has. Okay. And then you end up with an overly complicated estate where you've got lots of different tools very much siloed, which then means that you have to build out greater support teams because they have to know more technologies, the breadth is wider. So you end up with issues with hiring staff to come in or you just end up with bloat. And that's where architecture really plays an important role.
Why is that then?
Because it shows the value that we bring is simple in the simplification of the estate, which improves the BAU run and decreases your overall costs. And by that, I mean, we look at costs, not just in technology. We look at costs of business process. We look at costs of people. we look at the entire ecosystem that that technology lives within.
Okay. So you're almost changing the measurement in some respects, aren't you? The measurement isn't just technology cost, it's everything else. And then what's the value or what's the return on investment of that? And then that's how you demonstrate value of an architect. So are you saying that it's the architect's job to, or the architect's team, sorry, job to really understand at a business layer what impact that piece of technology or that process or whatever has, and then what it could potentially deliver and what that
is? Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
So why do businesses not value architecture more then, if that's the case?
Because I don't think a lot of businesses understand the value that architecture brings. They look at it very much as a project delivery resource rather than an organizational, transformational resource that happens to do projects.
Okay. But an engineer could do all that, or, you know, whether it's a support engineer or an infrastructure engineer, sorry, or a cloud engineer or a software engineer could surely look at that from a business perspective and go, this isn't working for the business. We need to find something that does, and then just completely cut out the architecture.
Could do, but historically I've found that people in those roles don't take that holistic view. That doesn't mean to say that they can't.
Yep.
And the ones that typically do end up becoming architects.
Yeah. Fair enough.
Because their scope is different. Mm-hmm. And typically also those people aren't necessarily in the right meetings at the right level.
Yeah.
Which is where architecture needs to be, but it is a battle, especially in smaller organizations, to get that viewpoint.
Yeah, fair enough. And there's an interesting statistic around, you know, either 82 or 84% of transformations fail. Again, I use that word failure as loosely as I possibly can, because it's not necessarily, you know, they've blown up a business or anything like that. It's more that they've not achieved the original objectives. And that could be a change of objectives along the way because the world's changed or technology's changed or whatever. But ultimately, businesses go on digital transformations to make a positive impact on a business. And 82 to 84% of the time, they struggle to do that. You've been in transformation programs from a consultancy perspective, from an end client perspective, working internally. From your experience in the variety of roles that you've performed, why do you believe that percentage of transformations fail?
Number one, I don't think they fall. Transformations, to be successful, need to be tied back to a really strong business strategy and tied back to specific points within that strategy and understood well. I don't think necessarily transformation projects fail. I think sometimes the scope of what they're able to deliver within the boundaries of what success looks like isn't actually aligned to what an organization is expecting.
Okay.
So you'll get your project team will go, we're going to do X, Y, and Z as part of this delivery.
Yep.
And it's going to take X period of time. And we need so much money to do it. And that project team will normally deliver within that scope.
Yeah,
but that scope's not really fully understood. A lot of times organizations, as I touched on before, don't understand that actually for a technical transformation to be successful, the organization has to transform to a certain extent as well, depending on what you're doing. So you've got that piece that often isn't factored in. And then the value that they perceive they will get out of the transformation isn't necessarily properly understood. So they don't actually get what they're going to, they don't understand what they're going to get.
Yep.
And then they stop.
Okay.
They stop. So we've done it. We're in. Tick in the box. Move on. Well, we didn't get anything from it. Transformation is not about project. It's not about a program of work. It needs to be continual. Organizations and consumers, especially in retail businesses and stuff, I know I don't work in those directly, but consumers are changing all the time.
Yeah.
They habits are changing. Our expectations as consumers of Netflix our shopping, Amazon, etc. We're changing continuously. We want something better every time.
Yeah.
In order for organizations to unlock the power of that digital first, you can't just go, right, okay, I've spent 5 million quid, I'm done. It's what's your running program after that? Yeah. How are you going to continue to unlock the value of that 5 million that you've spent?
Yeah.
I think that's where a lot of them struggle. They can't think beyond that. And yeah, because markets move so fast, you're chasing a set of goalposts that are constantly moving, and then they will move whilst your program is in flight.
Yeah. Should be an evolution program rather than a transformation program. Constantly changing.
The transformation program lays the foundations for the evolution to be built on.
Yeah.
It doesn't lay the foundations and then build the house.
Yeah. Okay. So a number of things there. Strategic pillars being completely aligned. Communication, making sure it's what's being communicated, what the value it's going to bring to the business, to the holistically, and so on. And then finally, it's not just, yeah, we've done it, let's move on to the next one for the next 5 years. It's we need to unlock more value out of the one we've just done and just continue to evolve that. Okay. Like, you've done a master's in enterprise architecture. Now, there's the whole education versus experience debate, which I don't want to get into, but suppose was that master's degree valuable? It's the only one from memory, isn't it, in the UK?
Yeah, there's not many.
Yeah.
Was it useful? So that was the last degree that I've just finished.
Yeah.
I don't think I'm going to do any more now.
taking the wind out your sails.
Doing it full time while working full time and with two children is not the easiest thing. What it forces you to do is read a lot. So one of the things, and it forces you to read a lot of academic articles and publications and a lot of books. So we all read as part of our jobs, or like, I believe we do. We'll read stuff from Gartner. We'll read stuff from Celent. We'll read, stuff from Accenture when they publish their papers. We'll constantly be reading up about Microsoft Azure or AWS and the new technologies that are coming out. Well, they don't always give you that holistic view.
Yep.
And they don't necessarily give you a view of where things have been used before or done before. So I think from that perspective, it was good. I think it cemented for me personally a number of things that I did already and enabled me to go, actually, yes, you're not an idiot. You are doing the right things. These are the sorts of things that organizations do. So it cemented a lot of my thinking internally.
Yep.
So I use that as a springboard. I think it adds a lot of value, and I don't think I would never deter somebody from doing it. Doing it well takes time, energy, and persistence.
Yeah.
And the irony is the courses that I have done, you can't do without having that industry knowledge as well.
Yeah.
Because it's not just purely academic.
Yeah.
There's like white papers and theses, et cetera, you need to write, and you need to write them well. You need to have an understanding of how it works. Things work in practice. So it's a really good sort of middle ground between the two.
How long did it take you to do, Mike, your master's?
It took nearly 3 years, but that wasn't 3 years of continual work. A chunk of that was waiting for, it took from start to finish 3 years to get my results. Probably took nearly 2 to 2.5 years to do it.
Yeah.
Maybe a bit less. And then there was a 6-month lag at the end whilst they marked the papers, then got them authenticated by external. You've also got to remember, I did this during COVID.
Okay. I can. Adds a extra layer of complexity.
Yeah. Let's go and do a start a master's degree whilst I've got my kids at home and we're in the middle of a pandemic.
Homeschooling kids on enterprise architecture.
they learned a bit about what daddy does. But it was one of those. It was quite an interesting process. And I would recommend it.
Yeah.
As long as you've got the time to devote to it.
What did you do your thesis on?
I did my thesis on something that was quite relevant for me at the time, because the organization that I work in has just gone to Safe Agile. And I did my thesis on, is architecture and is the role of enterprise architecture still valid within a sort of product-led agile delivery methodology process?
Okay.
That doesn't sound great, but you know what I mean? Yeah. And the resounding responses was, actually, yes, it's still got a point and it's still got a relevance.
Okay.
Even when you've got product teams designing solution and working with the business, the enterprise architecture function has to change from its historic ivory towery type role into something a bit more approachable.
Yep.
But it still has a place, and it still helps bridge that gap between the higher levels of the organization and the technology teams. Because you've got your product teams will be working with, so you'll have a, say for example, you've got a customer services app of some description. They'll be working with the customer services teams to help evolve that.
Yeah.
But won't necessarily be working at the layers above that. So that's where enterprise architecture comes in, bridging that top layer gap and providing the guardrails that the lower teams are developing against to ensure that we keep an environment that is as standardized as possible. So when I touched on it before around too much technology in an estate creates your business and creates a higher cost and BAU to support.
Yeah.
One of the things in the agile methodology, agile delivery method, enterprise architecture can do to provide the guardrails to ensure that we don't end up with a proliferation of technology. We have defined principles, etc.
Yeah.
And then you can leave the product teams largely to do what they want.
Yep.
As long as they operate within those guardrails. Because then you don't end up with the proliferation of tech in the production estate.
So what are the other functions then of enterprise architecture in agile delivery? That's one of them.
That's the key one.
Okay.
And then what you've got off the back of that is your standardized enterprise architecture functions, documentation review, principles management, all those kind of things, just doing those health checks. And then you've got the horizon scanning piece as well.
Okay.
So your product team should be doing some horizon scanning, but they'll probably only be scanning maybe 6 months ahead. Because what they're doing is working directly with business players, people within the business, to go, what do you need next? Where are your pinch points? So we can help improve those. What the EA team should be doing is going, for example, we should be looking at AI now.
Yep.
To see how we can feed that into our customer services team in, say, 18 months' time. How can it unlock value in that space? How can it improve outcomes for our customers in that space? And that's where that EA function really lives. That what's coming downstream in 18 months, you know what your current state looks like. You know it's evolving, but you've got a good handle on it. And then you work out how can you dovetail these emerging, I know AI isn't emerging as such.
Yeah.
But I remember having conversations with clients about cloud in 2013,
right,
and 2012, when it was just becoming productionized.
Yeah.
People were just starting to look at it. And I was still having similar conversations with customers at 2018 that I'd had in 2013 around, actually, they were just about now ready to move.
Yeah.
And I think that's going to be what's going to happen with AI. AI's been around a while. We've had Watson and other chatbots, but they've been very robotic.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if yes, say this. If not, say this. It's all decision tree based.
Yeah.
It still is to a certain extent. But as we go further forward, those decision trees are a lot bigger.
Yeah.
You've got a lot more access to computing power by default. So how can we dovetail some of that in without ensuring that organizationally your data stays secure, etc. Yeah. So there's all those sort of bits, and that's where EA fit really well. So you've got your guardrails piece to protect your current estate, you've got your future horizon scanning, and you've got your standardized sort of documentation reviews, review boards, technical design authority, and that kind of bit that sort of just fits in the noise of a day.
And I completely get that, but I'm going to play devil's advocate here a little bit. The whole purpose of Agile is to be able to move quickly. Surely if you're looking at stuff 18 months in advance, is the example that you gave, it's going to provide a lot of governance and guardrails and delays here and now than if there wasn't an EA function.
I disagree. It doesn't provide a delay because you've got your guardrails that your teams are working within.
Yep.
What we're saying is, using the AI example, is organizationally at the top layer, we're not ready yet.
Yep.
As a business function to ingest the new technology like AI.
Does engineering then, or product then, not get really frustrated at that? Because they feel that they're ready in their particular department. Might not, sometimes they don't care about the rest of the business. They're just like, right, we just want to play with this new tool.
and that is absolutely right. So yeah. We've got engineering that want to push for AI now.
Yeah.
But we're not ready organizationally to ingest that sort of capability.
Yeah.
And it is a bit of holding them back. And that brings to your point earlier about where you said, surely architecture isn't needed because couldn't software engineers do it? And you've just ironically answered your question, yeah, that software engineers, because they don't get where we are organizationally or as a business, they will push forward for new technology stacks when we're just not ready.
Yeah. Makes sense.
And the EA's job is to coach the organization to get them into a place that then allows us to open the gate.
Yep.
So the engineering team can run wild.
Makes absolute sense. Yeah. Makes absolute sense. And I hope people, technology leaders, are listening to this, and engineering leaders and everybody across technology listening to this and really understanding the value an architecture practice can bring, whether that's solution level, enterprise level, whatever it is. Just encourage your architects to play one level above than what they currently are, to understand the business holistically. And then that may solve, or at least make a dent in, the percentage of transformation programs that don't achieve their original objective. So thanks very much for that. So overall, masters in enterprise architecture was valuable. You took a load from it, made you read a lot more, and you definitely recommend people doing it, providing they have the time to do it. Makes sense. Mike, we're going to move on to our quick fire questions now. So what do you expect in 2024 will be a game changer from a technology perspective? And I know we spent most of the discussion talking around how, you know, it should be an enabler and might not always be a technology problem.
I'm not sure that there is one thing that's going to be a game changer. I think the use of data is increasing in organizations. So historically, data has just been seen as a thing,
yep,
that we've got. I know from current experience that we're looking at big data platforms. I know from past experience working with some central government organizations in my past life, we were looking at a properly big data platforms to crunch numbers. I think that will start to come more to a forefront, and I think they'll start to use AI to help gain insights out of those data platforms. And really look to use that to unlock value within organizations. I know some organizations are really good at it, but I would say on the whole, data is now really pushing up the agenda. It's been pushing up for a number of years, but I think it's starting to come to a head, and people are now not talking about it, but making the investments that are needed to drive that through.
Okay. Makes sense. What advice would you give to a newly appointed chief architect or head of architecture?
listen to your staff.
Direct employees, or as in direct management, line management, or everybody?
Yeah. So listen to your direct employees. Understand the shape of your team.
Yep.
Understand what they look like. Understand what their aspirations are, what they try and want to do. And then work closely with your leadership team, so your people above you, the CIO, etc. And also get out to the business, speak to the heads of departments, speak to as many people as you can to try and get an understanding of what they think.
Yeah. Okay. Any advice you'd wish you'd received early on in your career?
Get a mentor.
Yeah. Why?
Yeah. And somebody you can talk to that's unrelated to your workplace. So I have one right now. They are not a technical person at all. And that helps me by when I speak to them about some of the things that I face, some of the problems that I've got. They don't look at it through a technology lens.
Yeah.
They just look at it through a business lens. And that helps me refocus and reset my view. So I think that's really important. And I think it's important as technical people have a non-technical mentor as well. You may have a technical mentor or somebody that you looked up to in the department who's better than you, but actually get somebody outside of your sphere. So you gain those better insights. And I think that's one thing that I wish I got earlier in my career.
Okay. What's the hardest interview question you've ever had?
The one that everybody likes asking is, when have you failed? That's a hard one. And I think the only way to answer it is be absolutely honest when you've done something wrong. And the reason I think it's hard is because you don't like to admit you've got stuff wrong.
Yep.
And then other ones are, and it's also difficult with interview questions is so many of them are subjective and personal, and your answers are yours. And therefore, you never quite know if you've given the right answer or not.
Yeah. Yeah, fair enough. And from a talent perspective then, what's the biggest change you expect to see in the market over the next 5 years?
I've seen architecture change quite a bit over the last 5 years. So I come from a background of, racking and stacking boxes and moving into technical architecture and moving into solution architecture. And there's that broad sort of standard path that people can follow. Technical architecture doesn't necessarily exist like it used to anymore. It's more domain focused. Solution architecture kind of still exists, but the two are very mixing.
Yep.
The only one that has largely stayed static is application architecture, because that's probably far more in depth into the scope. The rest of them are slowly merging. Mm-hmm. So TA and SA is slowly merging into one space. And ironically, it's possibly becoming slightly more technical because of the requirements and the breadth of the role now.
Yeah. And businesses effectively being technology businesses or think they're technology businesses.
Yes. But it's changing so fast. So when I started, it was, you do your MCSE in Windows Server 2000. I'm showing my age, 2003, except you do your certifications back in then. They were good and solid. They asked you 5 years. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So that investment was worth it. In time and effort. They were difficult, don't get me wrong. But I remember when I did my AWS certifications in 2015, by the time I'd done them, they were largely out of date. There was still a valid certification.
Yeah, yeah.
But, AWS, I don't know how many, say they had 50 apps when I started, when I prepped for the exam and sat it, because I was working on AWS back then. By the time I'd finished the exam, they'd have 60 apps.
Yeah, yeah.
In their marketplace. A week later, they'd have 70.
Yeah, yeah.
It's continuous learning. It's not one and you're done and you're good for 5 years. It's, you pass the exam, you're doing it day in, day out, But there's a whole new product suite coming out next week, folks. Be ready for it. Another drop.
Fair enough.
Which is why I say it's becoming more technical, because you are having to continuously learn and stay on top of things as they evolve.
Fair enough. Well, thanks very much for that, Mike. Sadly, we've run out of time. Thanks so much for an excellent podcast episode. Been really interesting and great to chat with you around the detail of enterprise architecture in an agile environment, leadership, everything we've discussed, transformation or evolution programs as we coined it. So thanks very much for your time. Really, really appreciate it, Mike.
Thank you, Mario. Thanks for having me.
And that's a wrap. Sadly, we're at the end of another Transformational Blueprints episode. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed it and there were plenty of golden nuggets for you to take away. If you're a fan of the show, please do remember to share, like and leave reviews so that more people from our industry get to hear and benefit from these too. Please also follow Synaxia Group on LinkedIn to keep up to date with new episodes. Links in the show notes. Join us next time for another episode packed with tips and advice from senior leaders in the technology world.